Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Queen Tahira. You're listening to Sign of the Times Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by New Power Radio Network. Unfortunately, I'm having problems with Blog Talk Radio tonight, and as often happens with these newfangled, I guess, connections and media sources that we have nowadays, you can't actually call anybody and get a response and get things resolved. You have to go through all these clicks and bells and whistles and then still don't get things resolved. So politically, we are moving forward in a way that, you know, I'm not surprised if something like this would happen at such a pivotal moment in our broadcast history, if you will. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to cancel tonight. There's nothing I can do to get this up and running. It's not even giving me an option to click on the studio. But if anything happens, I will go ahead and restart tonight's broadcast. I want to let you know about a situation that's happening as we speak in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. There's a brother there who has done 15 years. Just was released on Mother's Day of 2018, and I'm trying to find the article, so bear with me. Just was released on Mother's Day of 2015, and the person that was involved in the assault unfortunately passed away a few days ago, and now the police are requiring him to turn himself in, as if this assault has just taken place. And I've done 15 years on conspiracy, and he served his time. And so we're looking for additional support for this brother. He goes by the name of Slim Jammer on Facebook. I'm going to see. I'm trying to find his post now so you can contact. The post that I saw was on a page by the name of Tone Bone, T-O-N-E, space B-O-N-E, and the brother, his phone number, where you can he can be reached, where you can reach out to him, is area code 412-545-4900, and he goes by the name of Goin Jammer, J-A-M-M-E-R, G-O-I-N, G-O-I-N, J-A-M-M-E-R, and we need as much support for him as we can possibly get. He was tentatively told by the police department there in Pittsburgh to turn himself in by 3 o'clock today. I'm not sure at this point if he has done that. But unfortunately, they were threatening his family, threatening to come get him in full-fledged assault. So I'm not sure at this point. It's 6 o'clock now, and I'm not sure if he did turn himself in. We said that he was. There's also a video. If you go to Sign of the Times page, if you go to the New Power Radio Network page, I will post it there as well as my Queen Tahira page. I will post his video there so you can look at it for yourself. But any support from out of the Pennsylvania area for this brother, he was 17 when he was convicted, which also qualifies him as a juvenile offender. And we know that the juvenile offender retrial initiative has been started going back to Miller versus Alabama because of the brain development of a 17-year-old. And so on. And so this brother has served 15 years. He served his time. He just got out Mother's Day. And now because the victim has transitioned, they want to bring him back in and recharge him for murder. So please offer any support you can give to this brother. Again, his name on Facebook is G-O-I-N, Goin, J-A-M-M-E-R, Jammer. And the phone number where they're asking for any legal assistance, any donations that you can make to try to help them gain legal assistance is area code 412-545-4900, 412-545-4900. So I'll keep you all updated if I find out on his case. And, of course, you know, that's what we do with the Freedom and Justice Movement and Redistribute the Pain campaign is aid and assist. So I was reached out to, so I'm reaching out to all my listeners, anybody that's listening, as well as I'm going to do my due diligence on my end to try to support him as much as possible. Again, the phone number where he can be reached is area code 412-545-4900. He goes by Goin, G-O-I-N, space Jammer, J-A-M-M-E-R. On Facebook, you also can reach out to our sister friend Erica, Sister Erica, that calls all the time. That's a good comrade of ours out of Pittsburgh as well. You can reach out to her on Facebook as well as Erica Yesko, Y-E-S-K-O, and I'm sure she's going to have some updates as well. So keep this brother and his family in your thoughts and prayers, everybody. If you would like to reach me, if you missed any of that information, if you want to find out how you can get involved and you maybe don't want to contact the family directly, feel free to give me a call at area code 513-913-2691, 513-913-2691. You also can reach out to me as Queen Tahira on Facebook, Sign of the Times, and New Power Radio Network. So I apologize, everybody, that I couldn't get in the studio, but I don't know what the heck is going on with Blog Talk Radio, but this is how they do it sometimes. So we'll get it worked out as quickly as possible. We do have a broadcast planned for Sunday School with Brother Will.i.am, the Wise Owl. So look for that Sunday afternoon from 2 until 4. So if you need me, everybody, give me a call. Keep my family in your thoughts and prayers as well. Y'all know I work hard for the community, but, you know, I do have a family. I am a grandmother. And, you know, I love my children and my grandchildren dearly. And, you know, it's been a process for them to be involved in all of the work that I do and to be so patient and understanding with me when I'm not always patient and understanding with myself. So any positive energy and love you can send to me and my family, we definitely appreciate it. Also, as a reminder, we do have a fundraising campaign going ourselves through GoFundMe. It's GoFundMe.com/New Power Radio Network. GoFundMe.com/Sign of the Times. You can also donate to PayPal. Our email address is SignOTheTimes19@gmail.com. SignOTheTimes19@gmail.com. The Cash App, a contribution. Cash App address is $QueenTahira, no spaces. $QueenTahira, Tahira spelled T-A-H-I-Y-R-A-H. And, of course, let me see, you can still mail it. Our mailing address is 1623 Dalton Street, D-A-L-T-O-N, number 14939, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45250. So if you missed any of that, reach out to me so we can reach it back out to you, 513-913-2691. We love you, everybody. I don't know what's going on with Blog Talk, but they suck right now, and I'm really disappointed that we didn't get a chance to have tonight's broadcast. I've had to reschedule with Brother Bobo. He's so patient. I appreciate him, too. I've had to reschedule with him twice because of family situations, and now this thing happens with the Blog Talk. So, all right, we're going to try it again on Sunday, y'all. We'll be here with Brother Will.i.am on Sunday School. Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. Salute.
Press play on the box. Press play on the box.
Revolution. Revolution.
My name is Russell Shokes III. I'm the son of Russell Maroon Shokes, who's a political prisoner out of Philadelphia. My dad was incarcerated because him and his comrades went down to shoot a police officer. There was an Amadou Diallo-style shooting where Cat was young and he was joyriding a car, and he ran in the back of his mom's alley kitchen, and the cops shot him in front of his mom. And so the whole neighborhood was outraged, and they went to retaliate.
But it went retaliating, being part of the Black Panther Party, being part of BLA, Black Liberation Army?
Actually, this was prior to them merging with them, and they had a small organization.
So what year was this?
This was, I would say, probably 68 or something like that. Or 69, something like that.
Right. And so was he arrested immediately or?
No, he wasn't. At some point, he went on the run for 2 years.
Okay.
As his comrades were caught on the scene almost.
Right.
And he was on the run for 2 years and went to New York and lived in an underground in New York for 2 years.
Right. And so when did he get – when and how did he get caught? I guess he got caught 1970?
70, 71.
Okay. And was he caught here in Philadelphia or was he
– He was caught here in Philadelphia. He was making trips back and forth to see his family.
Okay.
His moms, his aunts, his sisters, you know.
How did he become politicized? How did he become – I mean, was he always
– He was politicized through the actual actions in the city, through Rizzo, through the little boy being shot, through people coming at him and saying, we need to do something.
So it's almost –
We're gangbangers, you know.
Okay, so,
not
yeah.
Unless
so,
the community is being, you know.
Right, because the gang situation in those days was more territorial. Gangs protected communities.
Yes.
So it was
and
like,
this guy lived in the community. He
so
lived
he was,
right around the corner. He
so
was
it was
part
like that.
Of the, we knew him.
Right.
We didn't know. My dad knew him.
Right.
And so they felt compelled. They were politicized through the bathing.
Right.
Of the,
yeah, by living it.
Yeah, by living it. And they formed organizations, Black Unity Council, Buck organization. One of the first organizations that him and my aunts were involved in was called the Black Unity Council, or the Buck.
Right.
And the Buck merged with the Black Panther Party. And actually, the Black Panther Party recognized the Buck as really militant.
Right.
And they sought them out as a part of their military wing.
So your dad really... So this action was more of a politicized gang action in the terms of gangs, not in terms of like the Black Liberation Army or the Black Panther Party or any other
right
military
sure.
or militant actions.
Yes, and a lot of that came after the fact.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
That's
they
heavy.
Were yeah they were already organized in a certain type of way, and they were already being terrorized in the community.
Right.
And they were figuring ways to try to deal with that.
Right. Because there was no other option.
The police were, I mean, it was Rizzo time. And,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't just because you were still in a car and joyriding, you're just getting bopped upside the head just
right.
just because.
Yeah. It's like when that famous essay that Amiri Baraka wrote about bebop. That bebop, the strength and the energy of bebop came from being knocked upside the head,
right,
by cops,
right.
and by the system,
right.
You know what I mean? It was bebop,
right.
You know,
right.
yeah. In a sure. lot of ways, that was your dad.
That was my dad. Totally in the context of they were just trying to drink wine and sing on the corners, but getting beat for it,
right.
You know, and it was commonplace for the cops to throw you in the back of the paddy wagon and beat you and drive around town and let you out on the other side gang territory. That was common.
And let you catch a beating over there.
Let you catch a beating over there. My mom and dad met they were young in the context of just coming out of their late teens, early 20s. My mother moved up from Virginia. My dad already lived here. He's walking down the street. He sees her on Pine Street. He thinks she's beautiful. He puts his moves on. At this point, he's not so politicized at all. You know, they have kind of the perfect life in the context of after they got married. He had two jobs. They had the picket fence. They had two cars. You know, they had a perfect kind of family life, you know.
Right.
And so... my dad had got out of the gang warring and had got out of, you know, hanging on the streets and drinking wine on the corners and had committed himself to being a family man. And
after he met your mom.
After he met my mom. And then he becomes more politicized as the situation gets worse and worse and worse.
Right. So when does all that change? When does the family life kind of thing, when does that all change? Because your dad goes underground, so what, in 68?
My dad goes underground actually in 71.
Okay.
In 71, between 71
so
and 72.
But doesn't he get arrested for the thing in Philly?
he gets arrested for the shooting of the police officer in 71 after the shooting, but he had went on the run for 2 years.
Okay.
He had went on a run after that.
The whole time that he's on the run, is he
politicized?
Right.
Yes, yes, yes. He is politicized at that point. He had knew my mom for some years now. They had dated. They had had children. So they had children, so they had to get married. It was one of those situations.
Right.
They were young. He had his first kid, Teresa, my sister. So they immediately got married. You know, they didn't know each other really that well at that point of my daughter. I mean, they knew each other, but not in the context of a long-term relationship. It was one of those classic back in the day,
right.
I got you pregnant, we got to get married. And they were
and then,
growing from
and then
that
he
point.
Goes through this transformation, this
and
political
then he,
transformation.
Right, and then he starts.
Shortly after that,
he's going through this political transformation. He's still trying to, here and there, go and hang out with the boys after he had the baby and take a little sip, sing a little bit, doo-wop a little bit, and then try to go back and be family man and do jobs. And so that was a whole dichotomy for him, trying to be the family man and trying to still hang out with the boys and still be a regular person and sing and shoot the shit and, you know, and do what.
Right.
And drink some wine.
And at the same time that all this is happening, he's putting his life into a political context.
Yes. He's finding out that there is some politics in everything you do, life-wise. That's
right.
What he's kind of figuring out, that even though we're just fresh out of, you know, doo-wopping and gang warring, and even now and then, because I'm young and I just had a baby or what have you, and I'm trying to change my life, if my man calls me and they fighting, then I got to go and fight with them, even though I really don't want to, but I have to go fight with them.
Right.
So it was those type of situations.
It's residual.
Yes, very residual and very touch and go.
Right.
You know.
Because it's not, the things haven't completely
changed.
It
wasn't an absolute for sure.
But it's also the paradigm hasn't changed. You know?
No. It's still.
Cops are still coming around.
It's still oops upside your head.
Yeah.
You know, it's still watch your back late night in the street. It's still you get thrown in the paddy wagon and left in the wrong neighborhood.
Right.
It's still, you know, they'll beat you in the paddy wagon, you know.
So how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have 7 brothers and sisters, 4 by my mother and 3 by Sister Love, who is my dad's love interest in the political context. As my mother was apolitical and not interested in the Panthers, Buck, or BLA, or any organization like that, but really interested in her family and raising her family and being a housewife and a mother to her kids, which was losing interest rapidly with my dad because my father was becoming more politicized and looking for a woman who would be interested in those things. And Sister Love fit that mold perfectly for her.
How did Sister Love become?
Well, Sister Love actually was a friend of my aunt's who were politicized. My aunt Saida, my aunt Sue, they experienced a lot of what my dad had experienced. And so they all kind of became politicized together.
Okay.
And when my father would come home and tell stories about them gang warring or about the cops doing whatever they did, his sisters would obviously be compassionate, so forth and so on. And
they would put it in a political context, I'm imagining.
Sure, sure. My Aunt Saida was very good at putting things in a political context. And my Aunt Sue was on her way to Cheney, you know, college and things like that. And so it was just kind of a natural progression in the context of young people, you know, getting older.
So there's this really, there's this huge divide at this point in time for your dad between the old life and the life that he's sort
embarking
of
on,
stepping into.
Sure, there was a huge divide in that lifestyle, and it was very rough because my mother's not, you know, Whistling Dixie. She's a tough customer, and she's not just going to allow you to have these children and then, for lack of better terms, cut out. Not that my father was even trying to cut out.
Right.
You know, but he definitely had a dilemma in the context of there are some people in our neighborhood who care about the neighborhood enough to kind of stand up for it. And I'm a corner boy, and I always cared about the neighborhood, you know, and so I'm going to stand up for my neighborhood, too, even though I'm removed from it having kids and continuing to have kids, like stair-step kids, like one this year, one next year, one maybe a year and a half after that one. And this is interesting, too, in the context of sister love and his sisters and other people, women specifically, in the context of women. I want to say that my dad says, too, that a lot of times in the movement, a big mistake that they made, my dad will say this to anyone and has said it to me many times, is that they just didn't listen to the women. And if they would have listened, then maybe they would be in a different position.
That intuition.
Right, that sixth sense
right.
that women have, my dad and his comrades were moving around from New York here to there, and they were back here in Philly to do some expropriations or some bank robberies or to get food for the community, because they would rob food trucks and they would rob banks and they would give people sustenance, you know, things
right.
that they could survive on until
Robin
the
Hood.
Next time. Right. They would do the Robin Hood.
Robin for the hood.
Robin for the hood. They would rob for the hood, and they would come back and give people money, give them food, and they would be off again. So my dad was coming here with some Panthers from New York and a couple from here, and Mark Holder is one, and they did a bank robbery here, and they got caught. And they, you're Russell Shokes. Oh, yeah, great. We got you now.
Right.
We've been looking for
so we got you on the robbery. We got you on this murder of this police officer.
Right. Right.
And so it's 1971, and how does the trial go?
Oh, it's a slam dunk for the DA and, you know, in the state, because...
And what stance does your father take a political stance in the trial, or does he...
I don't think he took a political stance in the context of...
sort of like some people took
line.
Right. Some people took a prisoner of
a
war stand,
right,
where they would not participate in the trial, not recognize the United States government, that whole thing. So I was just
no,
curious.
He didn't do it that context. But what they did do was they, for lack of better terms, made an oath to each other that they wouldn't tell on each other. So
right.
to this day, no one knows who the shooter is in the Philly Five case. That's the Philly Five case.
Right.
You have five people doing life for the murder of one person. When obviously they all couldn't put their hand on the trigger and
right.
do the 5-1 killing. And so someone shot the police officer, but till this day, no one knows who
right.
shot the police officer.
Right.
You know? And I've asked my dad repeatedly, and you know, but, you know.
It won't give up.
He's not saying who the shooter is. And because of his actions, because of his escapes, because of so forth and so on, they've made him the ringleader, the mastermind.
Right.
It only could have been you, really.
He needs to be the example.
Exactly. He is the example for the Philly Five, even
and
though
for anyone else who's thinking about
it. Even though, in defense of the Philly Five, all of them have been made offers to either tell on each other or tell on my dad in escape moments or wherever it be to get free or to have their freedom. But in defense of them, they've never said anything. They had perfect opportunity to say, yeah, it was Russell, or yeah, it was Freddie Burton, or yeah, it was whoever, but they never did that. None of them.
That's an incredible example of loyalty.
Yes. And so my dad is doing, you know, double life plus a whole bunch of years with the escapes and all of that, but his comrades are doing a flat life bid, and really all they need to do is point a finger and they could get out of it at any given moment, kind of, sort of. But they're doing, they're holding on. The only thing that's stopping them from getting out of prison is saying, that guy's a trigger guy, actually. And so it's five people just doing time for one person, whoever that person is.
Right.
My dad escaped officially 2 times.
And the third time?
The third time is unofficial. And there's probably
unofficial in what sense? In that it's not recognized as being an escape, or
in the context of especially in those younger years, there were multiple attempts. They were always trying to liberate themselves. I think there was some type of code or oath, or just like they made to themselves to try to free themselves also.
Okay.
And so he was constantly trying to free himself.
But he, so he escapes twice officially.
Officially to where he actually got beyond the prison wall, where no one snitched, where the guards didn't figure out that he had some type of tool or a blade or something to get out with, or that there was some cement being punched from his cell or whatever and switched cells or whatever it may be. But officially, he only escaped twice. He was out the first time for close to a month, which was him, for lack of better terms, living off the land in rural Pennsylvania as the prison is out in the middle of nowhere and up against the odds of, you know, the FBI, the state troopers, the local police, the local community. Because in those days and times, they would call out the community, and they do nowadays too, just in a different way, like keep your eyes open, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But it would be like you could have your shotgun and you could go black man hunting.
So he gets caught and sent back?
He gets caught after that month out, and basically was a situation of the community movement not being in a position to be there, transportation or otherwise, for a person who liberated themselves.
Right. Okay.
The second time was actually planned through him entering himself into a psych ward as a lower security base. So basically, he played crazy. They sent him to the crazy hospital. He got a visit from a woman who was in the movement, and that woman smuggled in a submachine gun and a handgun. And she gave that submachine gun and handgun to my dad and his comrades, and they liberated themselves. 2 days later, they were in a gunfight with, you know, state troopers, FBI, you know. And because she really wasn't, it was wintertime too, and she really wasn't prepared in the context for frostbite and things of that sort, and she was starting to get that. And so they were negotiating, what do we do now,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we can't go on because she can't make it. And it was just rough. And actually, I believe Lumumba Fudge was killed in that escape. And
so how many people escaped?
Tim and two other people, and one of them were killed.
Okay.
And so he got charges from that too after that, you know, obviously. You know.
Right. When you were growing up, what was it like not having your dad around?
Oh, it was extremely rough for me. I was young. I was black. I was growing up in the hood. I was very keen to the fact that people didn't have fathers, and not just me. And so I kind of melted into that pot of the fatherless pot. And I became very disgruntled and angry about it, and very angry at him. And he would send me letters. I would ball him up and play basketball with him and shoot him in a trash can, or, you know, I would just, my aunts and uncles would take me up to the prison to see him as a little guy, and I would just be kind of lackadaisical or what have you. And I didn't care to really know the story at some points. You know, I cared to know the story later on as I became a young adult, a young teenage adult. But as a young teenager and as a young kid, I could really care less about the Panthers. I didn't understand the Panthers. I didn't understand the BLA or movement issues or anything like that, and I really didn't care, you know. And a very minute part of me, that child in me, still doesn't care, you know. And so our relationship, even till this day, is one of deep love for each other. But he also knows that part of me misses having a dad, you know.
And so everybody knew who your dad was?
Everyone knew who my dad was.
Growing up when you were a kid?
Growing up when I was a kid. He was on the front of newspapers.
How was that for you when you were growing up and your sisters and whatnot?
It was pretty rough for me and my sisters also. But there would be situations where, you know, kids would say, when's your dad going to break out again so we can have a day off from school? You know, that's cool, da-da-da, those type of situations. Teachers would give me a little extra hug and, are you all right? And spend more time with me and do a little more with me as a kid. And I wouldn't recognize until I got older that those things were directly connected to, you know, my father.
Right. And then how was your mother handling all this?
My mother wasn't handling it good at all in the context of, you know, your husband flipped the script on you for the most part. He was the great milkman and steel worker at a steel plant, bringing home big checks. You guys had two cars and a picket fence. And then at some point there was this jagged edge where, you know, you start finding guns and literature and as a sixth sense probably of a woman, suspecting that he's with another woman because of that sixth sense of a woman, or just like you're not here enough or those type of things. And just at some point probably really coming to grips with the facts that I'm losing my husband, you know, to the movement or to the streets. I grew up the youngest in my household because I only recognized that there were three of us growing up. But the story is that my mother's girlfriend, in the heat of all that we're speaking of, in the heat of my father being incarcerated, in the heat of him and my mother separating, my mother went to Virginia for refuge, and one of her best girlfriends said, hey, let me help you with the infant baby that you have because you're struggling too hard. You can't take care of four kids by yourself. And while you're here in Virginia, I'll just help you with her. So she did, and then at some moment just disappeared with the baby. And everyone tried to find her and look for her, but she was gone.
So your mom's best friend essentially kidnapped her daughter.
My mom's best friend kidnapped my little sister.
While she's an infant.
At infant age. My mother was distraught about it. Still is distraught to this day about it. Doesn't like to talk about it because it's not something that you really want to dialogue about.
Right.
It's very extremely painful and unexpected from a quote-unquote friend. But it's what happened. And so we would spend a lot of summers in Virginia, and my mother would spend a lot of time looking for our sister, which we didn't really analyze and really understand those trips to Virginia until we were older, you know. But at some point, my cousin, who's a good friend of mine, and we are just really tight, would ask me to come to Virginia and hang out with her, and we would hang out and party. We were young adults, and at some point, she said, it's this woman who looks just like your mom and Teresa. And so I thought nothing of it, and I went to go hang out with her one time, and this girlfriend of hers came to hang out. And when I saw her, I almost immediately, eerily knew that she was my sister. But how? Because I only have two sisters, and I never knew about a third sister, and she would be younger than me, and so forth and so on. So it was kind of weird, but it somehow got through the grapevine internally in the family, also with the aunts and grandmom, that the baby that got stolen is an adult now and here, and we need to deal with that. And so my mother went down with her sisters, and they dealt with that on the lawn of the lady who had stole the baby. They found her, found out where she was living, and they went there to confront her physically about stealing my mother's youngest child.
Was she ever brought up on charges or anything?
No, she wasn't. They didn't go to court and all of that. They didn't
just handle it.
They didn't handle it that way. They handled it community way.
Right.
Nevertheless, obviously my mom and my sister were estranged.
Right.
And very tense meetings followed afterwards, basically with the family saying, that's not your mother, you know, and her knowing and explaining to her cousins at some point that yeah, there are some strange things that have been going on, and I have been trying to get my birth certificate for a really long time, and I'm in the service now, and so forth and so on. I've been to Germany here, there, and there, so I'm kind of moving around outside of Virginia, but there are some strange going-ons that make me wonder if what you guys are saying is actually true, because I grew up with this lady. I grew up knowing this lady to be my mother.
Right.
But she treats me differently than she treats her other children biologically. And so after a while, it actually sank into her that we are your family. We're your family. You know, and so her actually being able to go through that brought her to a point to where at some point she wanted to know who her father was and meet her father.
The whole time that this is going on with your mom and your family and your sister, your dad's in prison.
My dad's in prison. He's also not aware of all of the ongoings in reference to the new development and so forth. And a lot of it doesn't get conveyed to him in the context of...
Does he know that she's not with you guys?
Yes. Yes, he does.
And he never conveys that in the time that you are
no.
visiting no. in the interim?
No. And in a lot of ways, you know, he just endures a lot in that context and kind of just keeps it...
Keeps lid on it.
Yeah, you know. It's,
wow.
It's not something to delve into with my kids, I guess.
So he has this... He has this weight or this responsibility that he's chosen politically, and then he's got this weight
that he hasn't chosen.
Right.
Outside
personally.
Of...
Personally.
Yeah, personally.
You know what I mean? I mean, there's like a political cost, which is its own preparation, I suppose. I mean, I'm imagining that the whole time that he's underground and he's got guns and so on and so forth, and they're doing expropriations and feeding the community and, you know, all this other stuff. There's a chance I'm going to get caught, I'm going to go to prison. But
right.
That's my politics.
Right.
That's
right.
The situation I'm living in.
Right.
This whole other bag with the family thing, there's not even a way that you could possibly imagine that.
No, there's, again... I didn't know it until my cousin came and said, there's somebody who looks like you. It looks like your sister. It looks like aunt, you know, auntie. And I just thought that was weird or whatever. But then when I saw her as my sister, and I saw her not as my sister, as this girl who we're just going to hang out and have a drink with, I'm like, that's my sister. Like, whether I want her to be my sister or not, and that might even be crazy, and I grew up being the youngest out of the family, and I knew I was the youngest. I'm the last baby that I was had or whatever, because my mom didn't have this conversation of, you know, my girlfriend stole your little sister, so you're not the youngest. Really, is there some young kid out there somewhere 30 years later, because when we find her, she's close to 30, you know, and so she's lived an entire life devoid of us, so it actually takes a adjustment period for her to even really even wrap her head around it.
Right. For everybody.
For everyone, you know.
But this is something that your dad can't see.
At all.
This is, you know, this is blindsided.
At all. Totally blindsided. And when he really sees it, I mean, he knows that we're gone, that we found her or whatever, but when he really sees it, it's years later when she musters the courage to go and meet this guy who's a political prisoner, who she's heard all this stuff about. She don't know. She's kind of a little scared. She's actually worked as a prison guard before, you know. And so she's really kind of feeling it out. And the tension grew even tighter at some point when she legitimately questioned her biological parents. Like, is he really my dad? All this other stuff happened.
Right.
You know, I could be anybody's kid, really.
Right.
Okay, now I figure out that she's not my mom.
Right.
But are you really my mom? Are you really my dad? You know, those type of, which are tough questions and hard questions for my dad and mom to actually have to answer as the real parents of this kid who are responsible for the fact that she ended up with this lady.
Right.
Not just my mom, but my dad too.
Right.
He's just as responsible as my mom is.
So how long has your father been in prison when this all comes about?
Oh. As long as I'm alive, 30 years or more.
So he's in prison for 30 years when he finds out
that his daughter, his youngest daughter, has been found and wants to see him and confirm that he's her father.
It's literally almost like your past coming back to haunt you.
Definitely, definitely for my mother and my father.
Yeah.
And I felt for both of them in that context because I have a daughter, and it would be unexplainable at some point, obviously, that, you know, someone stole you. You know, that's the answer. The answer is that we trusted someone and they stole you. That is the answer. And that person has been masquerading around as your mother. But that's not your mother. I'm your mother and that's your father. You know, and those people are just kidnappers, basically, at the end of the day. And so those conversations weren't easy at all. And in defense of my sister, till this day, she still needs more of those conversations. Because to say that one time is never enough, kind of, sort of.
Right.
You know, but again, it's extremely stressful and extremely painful for my mother. And she literally refuses to keep having that conversation over and over and over again. Although we understand that my sister needs that conversation, you know. And so a lot of times it's just a lot of us sisters and brothers dialoguing with her, you know, for lack of better terms, nurturing her, loving her, bringing her up to speed, introducing her to more family, so forth and so on. At adult age, at full-on adult age, you know. And she has a daughter. My niece Ashley, so forth and so on. So even those relationships.
So now it just gets exponentially complicated.
It's so complicated. So my father sees my daughter, who's his granddaughter, but hasn't seen
his other granddaughter,
who's a grown woman now, and just met his daughter, who is her mother. So the granddaughter.
Wow.
Is a whole nother question.
And so this is not something that one can prepare for when you go to make the decisions that one makes when they go through that political metamorphosis that your father did to say, I'm gonna go toe to toe with the system.
Right.
Because I don't see another way of resolving this. Not for myself, but for, you know, everyone who's been oppressed or downtrodden.
Mm.
This is the way out for us.
Right.
And so it's kind of a heavy thing to deal with because you don't have all the information in front of you when you make those decisions. When you made a decision 40 years ago to do certain things, this wasn't.
It never was part of the deal for my father or my mother, you know. And my mother, you know, bless her soul.
Or your sister, or for you guys,
right,
or anybody.
Grandmother, anybody, you know. And we all have, you know, been wounded, you know, in that context. And obviously, my sister bears some of the deeper wounds in the context of now at 30 plus sitting through trying to figure, okay, I know you guys said that's what happened, but now I have to actually integrate that into my life. Oh, I'm a Shokes. Oh, I'm a Christian. Oh, it's family reunion. Oh, I have to meet everybody. Oh, they all know that I'm that kid that
got took,
got stolen, or what have you. Oh, people are tense with me. You know, people are afraid of me. People, you know, I got to build a relationship with my father. What's that like? Oh, I miss my dad. Oh,
my
this
father
guy
who's in prison.
My father who's this. Oh, he has superstar status. Oh. Oh, well, whoop-de-doo. How do I fit into that? Who am I? You know, I used to be a prison guard. You know, I'm in the military. You know, all of those questions, you know, and just a lot to swallow.
Well, especially because she was in the military, she was a prison guard, it throws her whole life into question.
Sure.
With her dad.
Sure.
More so than, you know, anybody else.
Yes, and especially in the context of working and dealing with the state for long periods of time and feeling that the state is a part of you and help nurture you. And the state was actually an escape from this woman who I knew really wasn't my mother. And the way I could really get out of this kind of weird bias situation was to join the service early on and make a career out of it.
What was your dad's reaction to all that?
Oh, my dad's reaction is always the same reaction, is that he was very compassionate towards her. He was very open and very much feeling responsible. But at the same time saying, you know, I'm here, obviously. Like, I ain't going nowhere, you know, but I'm not refusing you, or I know you are my child, and I know that it may be tough for you to swallow, but when you can swallow it, you know, but we're here for you. I love you.
It's almost as if, you know, it's hard for me to understand how much of a Herculean effort it must take for him to sort of keep it together and keep his ideals intact in the face of being in prison, in the face of his family being torn apart, in the face of, you know, the contradictions that have arisen because of that. In other words, the state kind of saves his daughter in a on a certain level,
mm-hmm.
in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
It must take a Herculean effort to keep yourself intact. Never mind just yourself, but not just yourself, but also your politics, to keep your politics intact.
Sure. Well, like I said before, I think at any given time, any of the Philadelphia Five, you know, including my dad, have probably had moments where anyone else could have just said, you know, forget this, you know, loyalty crap, forget this, you know, no snitch policy or whatever you want to think of it as. But, you know, I need to just say that somebody else did it and I can walk or get less time or be out of this situation in a short amount of time in order to go and be with my family or deal with my situation or, you know.
And that temptation must have arisen when this whole thing with your sister popped up.
Oh, just at one point, for sure. For sure. Definitely, you had to.
I mean, in a lot of ways, I would imagine that if you were a political prisoner who was in prison serving time, that, you know, that your test would be just to serve your time. And it seems like when in your dad's case, it's a never-ending battle.
Yeah, I feel like just in, you know, losing his daughter, all of that, his fortitude is, you know, along with my mom's, you know, fortitude is really, really strong and sound, because I know in different points of it, I've broken down, you know. So I can only imagine as the parent, and I'm a parent now, and I just really can't even imagine that. I can't imagine any of it, really, in reference to my daughter. You know, I just can't really even, I don't know if I can make it through, tell you honestly. I'm just being honest with you. I don't know if I can make it under those, I guess I would have to make it, But it would be
it's not something you need to look forward to.
it would be very strenuous, and it'd be stressful. It would be really, really stressful, you know. Losing your kid to someone who you trust, to someone who you know. It's like, it would be like you taking my daughter, you know. It would be like my best friend taking my daughter, stealing my daughter. I would be out of my wits. It might almost drive me cuckoo. You know, I might lose it, you know.
Right. And so in a lot of ways, you know, you mentioned that both your parents had this fortitude because your mom didn't ask for this. Your dad didn't ask for it either, but he walked into it on a certain level of his own accord.
Of his own accord and having some expectations of
possible scenarios.
Right. My mom just kind of plopped in her lap, you know, like, you know, and having to sort through and deal and struggle with it, even the interrogations and the, you know, the door kick-ins and the, you know, the people at work, because I went to the school and she worked at the school. So, you know, it would be her bosses and her colleagues and other teachers who would be like, oh, your husband escaped from prison or blah, 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 or whatever. I can only imagine those conversations. I was a kid, but I know those conversations took place just by the way the teachers treated me. So I know, you know, in a teacher's lunchroom, you know, it's, oh, my God, Mrs. Schultz, you know, I don't know how you do it, blah, blah, blah. And I can only imagine my mom's answers, you know. And, you know, it just was not an easy situation personally, you know. And I can only imagine, you know, my mom's situation throughout work and her everyday life, you know.
And so do you think your dad regrets the life that he chose?
That's a good question, but I doubt it. I doubt it at all.
Even after the price that he's paid?
Yeah, even after...
Even after the price... Never mind. Let me rephrase that. The price
paying.
He's continuing to pay.
Yes. Yes, and it seems sometimes, especially with my sister, that, you know, after 30 years, you know, and someone who's your daughter, full-grown woman, you know, you're just meeting her or what have you, you know, comes up to visit you in prison, and you've been in prison already her whole lifetime pretty much, and now you're starting a relationship with her like you just met somebody. Not like you just met somebody. You just met this person. But this is your biological, you know, daughter. And this is the starting point. You have to start from here. You don't get anything else, you know. And you have to attribute some of that to yourself, a great part of it to yourself. And she's in pain. She's in a great deal of pain. And you have to attribute that, you know, a great portion of that to yourself, you know. And so in those contexts, I know it's not easy for my dad, and kudos to him in the context of being patient with her, being willing to answer her questions, you know, being willing to be, for lack of better terms, grilled, you know, over the charcoals about what, how, when, where, why. And so, yeah, she's a...
And your dad's in a special unit in prison.
Yes, yes. My dad is in a restricted housing unit, State Correctional Institute at Green. And Green, State Correctional Institute at Green, was built specifically to house and to be a control unit for the state. And when I say a control unit, I mean people who are on lockdown 21 hours a day. You know, they get to exercise in a dog cage for 1 hour, and they get a shower every 3 days, you know. And so that type of situation scenario generally renders people insane, you know. So he's lucky to be able to even have the conversation now with her after spending over 15, 20 years in solitary confinement.
Is that he's been in solitary for that long?
Well,
When did they build the shoe?
They built it, I believe, in the 90s.
That's right.
They built it in the 90s.
So he's it's 20 some odd years that he's been in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
When you visit him, are you sitting in the same room?
No, we visit in a non-contact cage with plexiglass in between. And when you visit, it's for an hour, unless you get an extended visit, and then that's 4 hours, and that's the most you can extend. And it's an SCI, Greene State Correctional Institute, in Greene County. Greene is the most southern county, southwestern county in Pennsylvania. So you drive out towards Pittsburgh, then you go south about 60, 70 miles as if you were going to West Virginia. And right before you hit the West Virginia border is State Correctional Institute at Greene.
And there's even the added weight of not even being able to have physical contact with anybody.
Oh, yes. That's
Or being able to have a conversation without this piece of plexiglass in front of you.
Right. Or in the general prison visiting setting, have a cup of coffee.
Right.
Take a picture.
Right.
Sit down, shake hands, get a hug in.
Right.
So the lack of contact also over the years is also a deprivation issue. When you don't get to contact people, you don't get to hug people, you don't get to, and then there's the lights and then there's the air conditioning. Nowadays, prisons are built also technically to be able to torture you in those ways. Too much light, not enough light. Too much cold, not enough heat. Too much heat. A little tiny pencil this big. A comb this big. Toothbrush that big. Because they can do it. And because they'll tell you, we can't spend a whole bunch of money on toothbrushes, so that's why it's that big. Or pencils. Or whatever it may be. Everything's that big. But it's also psychological at the same time.
So you've put in all this work to try and help you get your dad out. You're not alone. Other people have been along for the ride and done what they can do. What can other people do to help you get your dad out?
They can definitely support the family. They can definitely support him, write him, join his campaign. Google, go to his website, RussellMaroonShokes.com. But more importantly, an interesting thing that is developing and happening that's kind of coming as a kind of shock, as out of left field, as kind of not historically connected is the issues around the planet and the eco issues and even eco activists turning some of their attention from being permafrost activists and animal activists to being more coalition activists and asking people like my father to join on to their struggle and vice versa and them joining on to his struggle.
So there's an interconnectedness that's happening.
There's an interconnectedness that's happening that's being forced, actually, just by the times and just by the not just urgency now around my dad's case, but the urgency around just life in general and the overlap of that urgency just around life where, a lot of people in the movement, have said, well, it's been urgent all the time, to try to get these people out, But some of those people also are saying, hey, I've been in this movement for years, and we haven't really been balanced in the context of
making these connections?
Not just making these connections, but
between struggles?
Sure, between struggles, but also just realizing that there's a real sense of urgency on the planet now. you know, with the Arab Spring or whatever it may be, Occupy stuff, whatever. But there are also contingents of people who are stepping outside of their comfort zone, you know, to possibly deal with some issues. And in my father's context, too, stepping outside of his comfort zone to deal with people who historically may not have dealt with him. Historically, he may not have seen their issues. But now seeing and understanding vice versa importance of their separate struggles. But even, I think, more importantly.
So do you think that these are just kind of sort of like, you know, the Native Americans describe the world as, you know, strands on a web. You think that these strands are finally recognizing that they're a web?
Yes, I don't think they're recognizing it per se. I think they're just forced into it. You know, there's a sense of...
They're forced to travel down
that
the rest of that line to find out that it's connected to something else.
Sure, sure. And I don't think that my dad's devoid of that. I don't think I'm devoid of that. You know, it's a real thing that people have gotten away from growing food. It's a real thing that Monsanto's will grow it for you. And it's a real thing that you might grow an arm out your neck. Like, that's a real thing. It's a real thing. And I don't want to think about it in some crazy conspiracy. You know, I'm not an animal rights activist. You know, I'm not, you know, Mr. Super Green. You know, but I am changing my ways, you know, in reference to everything from what I'm eating and putting in my body to recycling. You know, not that I think that recycling is the end-all, be-all, you know, but I don't think that landfills are make any sense at all, actually, at the end of the day. And that's what the people do with my trash, per se. And so I'm thinking about all of those things in a different type of way.
As a result of this sort of, call it an awareness between these different struggles, you feel that sort of like all the boats are rising in the bay, so to speak.
All of the boats are definitely rising in the bay, but I must say this, that there have been people, indigenous people, quote-unquote hippie people, quote-unquote, not even quote-unquote, move, you know, and move, they're not hippie people to me, but I feel as though their involvement with Mumia, so forth and so on, has really skewed what people actually visualize and understand about MOVE. But nothing, and when I say nothing, when I say absolutely nothing, that people think about the permafrost movement, the animal rights movement, or anything like that, is remotely even close to new to MOVE. Yeah, they think outside of the box, and that might scare you. And yeah, they're a little unconventional. And that might scare you. But they were attacking the zoo 20 years ago. Let them out. Let them out. They're walking around like this. That's the animals. They're walking around like this. The animal just pacing back and forth like this. And that's inhumane at some point. Prisoners do that same pace back and forth.
It's funny you're talking about the zoos because it's a prison.
It's a prison for you to get your rocks off and come
see some animals.
It's a weird kind of get up, you know, but that's what it is at the end of the day. And I don't need to see animals like that. I've never enjoyed seeing animals like that, even as a kid. And so now people say, oh, that's important. But that's been important. And they've been saying it was important, but because they didn't wear it, they might not wear as many clothes, and they might not style their hair the way you style your hair, and Pam might say, motherfucker, 20 times. You might be uncomfortable with that. But nevertheless, they've been saying that already. What you saying already, they've been said that a long, long time ago. That's what got them into trouble initially.
Yeah, MOVE was the house that was, or they were the organization or community that was
bombed.
They were the only community in the history of the United States that the United States has bombed. They bombed their own citizens.
They committed war and atrocities on citizens. I mean, unarmed children. About permafrost issues, about animal issues, about this is what we're talking about.
Right.
We're not talking about, yes, MOVE armed themselves in some small part of their history. You know, you can see them with arms. But MOVE is a life organization. They didn't have the strategy that the BLA had. They weren't doing military actions per se. They were defending themselves with those guns. That was after they had been attacked, you know, and attacked and attacked and attacked. And then they were like, well, we can't. We got to do something, you know.
In the same way that your father was defending his community.
Sure.
Does your dad think that he's ever going to get out?
I think my dad is always thinking he's going to get out.
So on top of all this, he's still hopeful.
Yeah.
In an otherwise, he's under these inhumane conditions, and yet he still manages to hold on to hope, which is, you know, as human as it gets.
It's as human as it gets, and it's interesting because he meets and organizes and talks with tons of prisoners, and that's being in solitary. That means that hour in the dog cage outside may be him screaming across to such and such, or that might be a kite note to somebody on a string, or that may just be 100 letters per month from people out in the street or other prisoners or people segueing or whatever it may be. But he keeps a high level of contact with people. You know, if you begin to write them today, you're going to stop writing first. You're going to stop being a pen pal first. You know, so. And I'm talking about over 20 years, certain people just.
Back and forth. There's volumes. There would be volumes of these conversations.
Well, I have volumes of letters. Just at some point, I'm going to publish the letters between Russell and Russell III because it's just literally volumes.
Wow.
Of different issues around everything you could think of in my life. From, oh, I'm about to have a kid, oh, this is what you need to do, blah, 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 I'm so happy, blah, 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 whatever it may be. Oh, you read this book, oh, you see that, what's the Spike Lee movie about Malcolm X, how was that, blah, 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 whatever it may be. Whatever it may be. Oh, did you read this? Did you see that? What's going on in the streets? Oh, they tore 52nd Street down. Oh, they're building it back up because all of these things happen, you know. One of the things that was interesting, one of his comrades had been in as long as he had been in, got out from prison, and was totally shocked by a moving seatbelt that just moves across you without you doing anything, you know. So those type of
situations. The things that we sort of take for granted
that, you know, after X amount of years, you know.
Because it's almost like they're locked in a time capsule.
Sure.
And they come out and all of a sudden it's like they're on another planet.
A total new planet. And things have changed, you know. Yeah, it's still the same block, but now they tore that building down and now it's condos there. Well, yeah, there used to be projects.
Right.
But now white people live in it, and they cost, you know, XYZ and they're upscale. You know.
Do you think your dad will get out?
I do believe my dad will get out. Interesting enough, with all of the work that I've put in over X amount of years, to not see him out at this moment right here, right now, is trying, you know, at different given points, because I feel like the work that I put in was quality work, and I feel like the work that I put in was substantial. You know, it wasn't like Whistling Dixie, and it wasn't easy work, and it wasn't sloppy work, and it wasn't just ho-hum work, you know. So with all of that said, I'm not discouraged at all, but at the same time, I can see how other people have become discouraged, or people have fallen by the wayside in reference to his campaign. Get it off. Get it off on the left.